Hey, deserving listeners, it's just me today. I thought I would answer some patron emails. If I sound sick, it's because I am. I actually recorded an hour and a half episode talking about the whole extravaganza, but I listened back to it and thought it was super boring and self-indulgent, so I deleted it and thought I could just quickly summarize that hour and a half in the following quick summary, because there are some details here that I find to be interesting. So it all began when I pulled a muscle. I was playing with the dogs and I snapped. I felt and I think maybe heard one of my calf muscles snap a little bit. I don't think it was a full tear, but it was significant. And I was taking care of it, and I gave myself frostbite because I applied the ice to my, this will all get to my sickness in a second, but this begins, this is the beginning of my health journey in the last month. I was icing it, which you're supposed to do, but I forgot that I had put the ice on my leg, and it was there way too long. And long story short, I gave myself severe frostbite on my calf. So not only did I have burst blood vessels from the torn muscle, but I also, underneath the skin, you know, you have this sort of blood blister thing happening. But then on top of that, I gave myself pretty nasty frostbite. Essentially, I just killed a bunch of my flesh, which was really stupid. And then I... long story short, because I had to bandage all that up because it was an open wound on my leg, I was using a new brand of bandages, and this particular brand of bandages uses this particular kind of disinfectant that I had not an allergic reaction to, but a very pretty severe sensitive reaction to, and I later found out that this disinfectant is known to cause reactions in a lot of people, something like 30-40% of people or something. And I'm thinking, why do you put this disinfectant on your bandages? So so I'm describing a journey of about a month here, limping and recovering and talking to my doctor and everything. And the pseudo-allergic reaction was severe. I mean, it was pretty gnarly. But anyway, so that kind of began my whole health issues and bad luck. Then I went to Spokane for two memorials to people in my sort of distant extended family members had died recently. And it was this huge family reunion in Spokane. And I was limping around and I had this bandage on. And at the time, I didn't know that my body was rejecting the bandage. But while I was in Spokane, hugging and kissing everyone and really just enjoying seeing all my relatives, because we're a pretty tight-knit family, and also seeing my parents and my siblings and walking around Spokane and visiting all the old family historical sites, because a good chunk of my Japanese ancestors come from Spokane and used to, you know, own buildings, and then it was lost. Or I don't know. Anyway, during World War II when the imprisonment happened. Anyway, so I got sick in Spokane because I was in contact with a number of my relatives got sick. Stacy and I both came down with a pretty bad cough. It wasn't awful as a sickness, but it was annoying at night because you'd have these coughing fits at 3 a.m. that would interfere with sleep. And I didn't want to spread whatever I had. It wasn't COVID. We tested multiple times. And I didn't want to spread it around. So I was being very careful about isolating, even though it was a non-COVID virus, because that's the empathic, compassionate, socially responsible thing to do, which I am full support of. But that meant that I had to miss a lot of things. But strangely, this month, end of July, early August, Stacy and I had so many different activities planned that I was really looking forward to. I mean, there were so many things that was going to miss probably, and I did miss the Seattle Art Fair, and you know it's a really big event for me and Stacy. We usually make it a date night, and I love going to the art fair. It's just really the best. I go to a lot of Stacy because Stacy's an artist, so I end up going to a lot of art shows and with her. She often will sell pieces there or will win awards, you know, best in show, that kind of thing. She almost always wins some sort of award whenever she submits her art. And I have found that the Seattle Art Fair is really the top-notch art fair. So many things to look at. I mean, even if you're not interested in art, it's just so interesting. There's often guest artists that will do these performance pieces and stuff. Like there's this one Japanese woman a few years ago who she was well known for this. She would meticulously and quietly align all these different breads on this on these long tables, you know, like 30 different kinds of bread, like muffin and bagels and wheat bread and scones. And then she would proceed to quietly, with a very stoic face, walk up to each bread pile and then smash her head into it. You know, you think, wow, I guess that's what artist people do. But everyone in the audience was cackling with, not laughing at her, I don't think. It was laughing with, I think, because it just was so hilarious. And then I think afterwards you were invited to come eat some of the bread. I don't know. But, you know, artists. So, you know, that's why the Seattle Art Fair is the best. Well, I had to miss that, which really sucked. I had to miss the Bellevue Art Fair, which is a kind of a nostalgia thing for me. I remember going to the Bellevue Art Fair as a kid. And it's a very extensive art fair in Bellevue. Anyway, I also had to miss a live podcast of TBTL, my favorite podcast. They were having their 4,000th episode. I got tickets for Stacy and I, again, another date night that we were going to make, and had dinner reservations at a nice restaurant. Couldn't go out that night. I mean, the whole time, you know, we were thinking, well, we probably could go. A lot of other people probably would go because we're not really sick and we're probably not contagious anymore. And, you know, I was talking with my doctor and he's like, well, you could be contagious, but you might not. And he's like, yeah, you could just wear a mask. And I'm just like, I don't know. Stacy and I hate it when we're out and about and we can hear people coughing in that way. And I just think, why are you out? You should be home. And I just didn't want to be one of those people. And so I stayed in. Also, another whole big thing was that my drummer from Mexico, he moved back to Mexico, you know, 10 years ago, and the band Bread Knife Incident had to basically break up. And he was, a year ago, he's like, I'm going to come up to Seattle for a month and we're going to write music and we're going to record in the studio. And so I booked studio time. And so he came up, and before I got sick, I managed to actually hang out with him once, which was great. But then I got sick and we couldn't rehearse because I was sick and I didn't want to get them sick. And so we couldn't rehearse before our studio time, and we only have so much time. And I haven't, we haven't played together really in 10 years. And I had been spending the last year writing new music and sending it to him and culling it down to like 4 songs that we're going to record. And we didn't have much time to rehearse so that we'd be prepared before going into the studio. And we were going to miss out on like half the time that we'd have to rehearse. And it wasn't enough time to begin with. So I had to cancel those. I had another friend from out of town, Christy, who listens to the podcast, who I was going to see. We did manage to see her one night, but we were going to see her also at the Seattle Fair. I couldn't hang out with her. So, you know, these two really good friends of mine who are in from out of town, and I can't hang out with them. So far, it's not the worst situation, but it's not great. And I was getting serious FOMO, especially because I wasn't particularly sick. You know, I just had this cough, but I, you know, just sitting at home going, oh, I could be there. I could be there. What about that? And I was like, oh, I can't just stay home. It just sucked. So then I was out of the woods in terms of contagiousness, clearly after a couple, you know, a week or two. And then it was my parents' 60th wedding anniversary. I know some of you know that my parents had their 60th wedding anniversary in June, and I've been personally planning. I'm in charge of this 20-person family reunion in Lake Chelan, which is in Central Washington. And I have been, you know, coordinating and making sure all my siblings and all of the grandkids and their partners and everyone can come, and making sure that we have accommodations. And I, you know, was planning all this and really, really, really looking forward to it. We always have a great time with these family reunions. And 10 years ago, we went to Yellowstone with the same group. And it was just this epic trip that we still think about. Some of you might have seen a couple clips that I have included from that trip in videos or in audio episodes. One is when me and my sister and Stacy and my niece are talking about farts. And then the other one was when we're singing a song about, we wrote a song about Yellowstone together as a family, and it ends with poot. You know, that was all from that 10 years ago. So, there were so many other stories from that trip that were just so epic. And so I was really looking forward to the 60th. Well, it starts out great. Starts out just like I was hoping it would. But a couple of days in, one of us comes down with COVID, starts getting sick, test positive. Sooner or later, it starts moving through the ranks, because it, you know, whoever had it in the beginning before they had symptoms, they were you know, transmitting the virus, or we all got it from the same person. It's hard to know, but as soon as someone tested positive, we all took, you know, a lot of precautions. But then I got it, and about halfway through the week. But it was already, the trip was already majorly impacted, because people were isolating, and we couldn't spend time inside together, and we had to cancel reservations for, you know, boat trips and other kinds of stuff. And so it was just really a bummer. And then I came down with it about halfway through, and I was worried that if I got really sick on vacation, it would suck. So I made the decision to leave early, and thank God I did, because by the time I got home, I was so miserable that I went straight to bed, and I didn't leave my bed. I was just going to take a nap. It was like 6 o'clock or something, and I'm thinking, I'll just take a little nap. I'm really tired. And I didn't leave the bed except to every now and then go to the bathroom. That's all I did. And if I had a bedpan, I probably would have done that, because I was in so much pain. I didn't leave my bed for 2 days straight. It was excruciating. I was in just utter agony and pain, and psychologically too, it was affecting me, and I was miserable. I couldn't get comfortable. I didn't want the lights to be on. I just had to, I couldn't watch Netflix or TV or anything, because I just couldn't get the energy. It's weird how you could be so sick and miserable, and I guess maybe depressed, that you can't even casually watch TV, because you don't want to put the effort into, you know, getting out the computer and, you know, logging on to Netflix and, or even just paying attention to something, because all I could do is just kind of stare into the darkness. I could listen to some podcasts, kind of. You know, it was a really miserable time, and you know, it's a few days after I recovered from that, and I'm the best I've ever felt so far, but I'm still not great. And Stacy is following me in symptoms. She's pretty bad right now. She's just laying on the couch watching. There's like a marathon of the Twilight movies on some random cable channel, and she's watching that. And we were kind of making fun of the movies earlier, but anyway. So we both got COVID. I haven't. Not only have I never had COVID, to my knowledge, but I haven't been sick, I believe, in maybe like 4 years plus, because I never got sick at all during the pandemic. And then I generally don't get sick very often anyway. And so before the pandemic began, I don't know if I had been sick that winter. I might have been, but at the very least, I hadn't been sick in maybe the longest I'd ever not been sick. And it was very weird just to even have that initial cough, but to have that COVID thing, like, and I still have it and am still isolating and blah, blah, blah. And even though I was, you know, fully vaccinated, but the last vaccine I had was for a different variant, and it was almost a year ago. So, and I remember asking my doctor, you know, could I get another booster? And they're like, we don't really have one. So, you know, I guess I now have one because I just came down with it. And hopefully I don't have any kind of long COVID situations, but, you know, time will tell. So then, now that I have COVID, even though presumably I'll be better in a few weeks or something, I have to cancel everything else that I had scheduled. Not only can we not rehearse as a band to go into the studio, we can't go into the studio at all. So my friend from Mexico that's been planning this trip, spends all this money, comes up here with his family, and we're not going to be able to record at all. It's just completely, you know, the whole reason why he was coming up here is just completely negated. And Stacy's 50th birthday party was supposed to be today, actually. And of course, we had to cancel that. And that sucks, right? We'd been planning that for a long time. We had all these kind of things planned for that and paid for. We'll just miss out on that. And I'm probably going to have to miss this poker party with Umberto and his brother and this weekend. And I got front row tickets to Ben Folds. So, you know, you think front row tickets to see Ben Folds, you think, wow, that's got to be expensive. It wasn't cheap, but it wasn't, it wasn't unaffordable. It was $150. That's a lot for a ticket. But, you know, when you think Taylor Swift tickets are going for God knows how much. But I have discovered that when you want to, I really love sitting front row. You're right. You know what I mean? Like, because you sit, it's strange how just being like 25 rows back, it's kind of hard to see. You want binoculars almost. Like, I want to be able to really distinguish the facial expressions of Daryl Hall as he sings Kiss on My List or whatever. And so I like sitting closer, but they're often too expensive or they're not available. Well, but sometimes single seats will be available because usually people go in groups, right? So if you just want one ticket, sometimes you can sit in the front row and it won't even be that expensive. So that's what I did. I asked Stacy, I was like, do you mind if I see Ben Folds by myself? And she's like, I don't even know who Ben Folds is. So yeah. Sorry. I still have the cough. So I'm still recovering from the original cough. I think, I don't know, maybe COVID gave me another cough. What other symptoms? Fatigue. Things taste a little funny. I hope that doesn't last. I had no appetite. That was when I really knew that I was truly, truly sick, was was when I didn't want to eat anything. I am constantly eating and hungry all the time. Stacy will sometimes, she'll get hungry and she'll be like, ooh, you know, I'm a little hungry. I'm thinking about eating. Are you hungry? She'll ask me. And I always say the same thing. I was like, I'm always hungry. I'm never not hungry. I'm just different degrees of hungry. Sometimes I'm famished and sometimes I'm just hungry. Sometimes I'm hangry. Sometimes I'm peckish. And, you know, I'm never just like not hungry. There's a funny story from my Auntie Carol, who says that she had this weird sensation in her stomach. And so she goes to the doctor and the doctor asks all these questions. And then the doctor, you know, is trying to figure out, and there's nothing, it doesn't seem like there's any kind of disease or anything. And the doctor says, well, describe your symptoms again. And Auntie Carol describes it. And the doctor's like, I think you're hungry. And the joke is that in my Japanese side of my family, we never give ourselves time to be hungry. So we don't know what that feels like. And so when we feel it, we're terrified and we go to the doctor. I feel like I'm that way. Like, I can't remember the last time I legit actually felt hungry, you know, where your stomach is growling. And anyway, so when I couldn't eat anything. There's nothing. I was thinking maybe a Clif bar, but I was like, oh, and it wasn't nausea. It was just like, I don't know. It was weird. I just didn't want to eat. It's like, no, don't. I think it's an instinct that your body goes through to try to, I don't know. It seems like you'd have the opposite. And usually I am. When I get sick, usually, you know, people say, oh my God, I lost 7 pounds because I had the flu last week. And I'm like, what's that like? Because when I get the flu, I either eat the same or more. You know, it never happens. But this time with COVID, yeah, no appetite. I finally was able to choke down a bagel with cream cheese. And Stacy's kind of in that zone right now where all she can choke down is a bagel and cream cheese. Anyway, so then today, which is Sunday, Stacy and Alina, who is my brother's kid, who works for the podcast and reviews all the episodes before they get published, they're both telling me that there's no episodes for next week. And I'm like, are you sure? And so they told me this a couple days ago. Stacy told me a while back, but it was in the midst of my COVID, and I was, and I didn't even, that was another thing. Like, my brain just was completely offline. It's almost like I was in a dream state or something. I did have a fever, but not severe. I didn't hallucinate or anything, but and then Alina tells me after I emerge from COVID, and I'm like, oh shit, I better make some episodes for next week. I thought I had already recorded a bunch, but I did not. And yesterday I was when I recorded the hour and a half of me yammering about, I'm already at about 20 minutes of me yammering about it again, but I my brain wasn't working well enough yet. I was powering through. Today, I feel like my brain is 90%, so I can start making some episodes. So that's what we're going to do today. And let's take a break. And when I get back, I'll answer some emails. All right, we're back from the break. Oh, one last little thing is that in the hour and a half episode that I recorded yesterday, the thing that I eventually landed on was just the grief of having to miss out on things. And I know a lot of you missed out on much greater things than I did. And obviously, some of you have lost family members to COVID or have long COVID or something. And obviously, that's much worse than what I went through. And for some of you, you had to miss your wedding, or you had to, I think one of the listeners was saying that the couple couldn't go to the reception, but everyone else, and they're trying to get everyone else to go because, you know, the couple getting married was the one that actually got COVID. And they're like, but we've already paid for everything and everyone's has already flown in from out of town. So how about everyone get together without us? You know, you don't need us there. But a lot of people didn't bother because they're just like, well, why? And it just really is a huge loss, a lot of grief. I got a small taste of that, missing out on all the things that I'd been looking forward to and disappointing other people. You know, they're not disappointed in me, but having to completely inconvenience two of my friends that are in from out of town and, you know, the band, and just, it sucks. And, but necessary, but sucks. And for those of you that had to miss bigger things, and for those of you that lost people, it's we're still in it. It's still happening 3.5 years later. So that's what I'll say about that. All right. Let's go to an email here. Oh, actually, there's this other thing I want to talk about before getting to an email. It is a Reddit post. I actually came across, or maybe Alina, who will look on Reddit sometimes for people talking about the podcast, came across this post, and someone was talking about emotions. I only have this one section of the thread, but someone was on Reddit was talking about emotions, and someone was replying to the OP saying the following thing. It says here, I've been listening to a podcast about psychology and counseling called Psychology in Seattle. He talks about emotional processing as follows. So just chiming in, you know, sometimes I'll talk about my model for quote unquote addressing or coping or dealing with emotions. And I remember when I read this comment a few months ago, I thought, wow, this person really gets it. So if you're listening out there, I sometimes say this, but it bears repeating that I think it comes from being a professor. When you're a professor, you really prepare a long time and you put a lot of effort into conveying certain ideas to the students. And not only because it's a requirement that students understand these ideas before they are passing the class, but you also just care, right? Particularly as a therapist. And when I have students that can repeat to me off the top of their head without looking it up things that I've been wanting them to get into their head, it means that it worked. And I feel very accomplished as a professor. It's like, ooh, because it's one thing to convey an idea and to have a student nod their head and move on with their life. It's another thing for the idea to take residence in their, to take up residence in their mind and then mull around in their brain so much that they are able to just speak it from their own words off the top of their head. So when I saw this comment on Reddit, it was along those lines. But I also thought it'd be a good opportunity to kind of review it because I use this all the time in for myself. And I'm guessing there are other models that are similar to this, maybe even one that's very similar to this. I've never come across one that's like this, but I didn't do a dissertation level lit review on this kind of thing. So I don't want to claim that I'm the only one who's come up with a model like this, but because I'm sure I haven't. But so he going on here with the comment, he talks about emotional processing as follows. How to deal with one's emotions. We start with, what am I feeling? Why am I feeling this? As in, what is the direct cause? So I believe that, I should look at my notes and figure out my exact model, but yeah, I'm sure that's a big part of the beginning, which is, when people talk about like, how do I deal with my emotions? Or I'm feeling a lot of emotions, what do I do? Well, the first thing is to figure out, well, what are you feeling? Because sometimes you can have a variety of feelings or even just one feeling, but we will avoid going in beyond the surface. And so we just know something's wrong or we feel some level of distress. You know, it's sort of like if you're a partner, your husband is hanging out with an old friend who is a woman and you're a woman and your husband's heterosexual and you just hate that woman. Okay. So that's the feeling that you're having. It's just hatred for that. Like, I hate her. I just hate her. Okay. But that's not really the feeling that you're feeling. That's a feeling you're feeling, but the feeling you're feeling is terror. You're worried you're going to lose your husband, right? That's the feeling. And then not only what is the feeling, but also why am I feeling this? What's the threat, you know? And then the other section here is, what is the emotion trying to tell me? If it could talk, what could it say? For example, anger exists to alert us when our boundaries are being crossed. So emotions are alerting us to our needs. Chiming in, yeah, absolutely. This is the core of my model, which is, you know, I didn't invent this. I'm quite positive, but I can't really point to a source that I got it from. But it's, you know, the well-understood notion that emotions evolved within us for a reason, and they evolved in us to help drive behavior to enhance our survival and procreation, which, you know, as now, not everything about our experiences and our biology and our psychologies have to do with that very reductionistic view of you know, evolution. But the biggies, you know, it's very easy to draw some conclusions that are tentative because we can't know, so we have to experiment. But it seems pretty obvious that we evolved anger to motivate us to take action when we're being violated in some way, right? I'm having a hard time talking. I'm having COVID brain, but and that we evolved lovey-dovey feelings because it benefits us to be very focused on our partners, so that, you know, we're going to bond with them and have sex with them and have children with them, right? And so on. So when we, but there's a lot of different emotions for a lot of different reasons, and we just have to have some awareness around that. That the emotion is this intermediary between a stimulus. You know, we're observing something, we're perceiving something, and then we're interpreting it in a certain way, and then we're having an emotion from based on that interpretation, and that emotion is trying to push us to do something. There's a, you know, it's giving us an urge to take action, and given how a lot of us have been traumatized, and really all of us have been traumatized or at least hindered in some way regarding emotion, you know, shamed or limited in some way, that it's hard for us to know what we're supposed to do, you know? Plus, there are a lot of impulses that we have that we shouldn't take action on, right? Like when your boss is telling you that you need to come in on the weekend and you feel like you're being violated and you have an urge to punch him in the face, you shouldn't punch him in the face, right? But you should notice the urge and the feeling. Okay, well, what is it? What's the urge to punch him in the face? Even trying to get me to do well, it's trying to get me to push back on this violation. I don't want to come in on Saturdays. Anyway, going on. And then after you notice what it's trying to tell you to do, make a plan to assess those needs and implement it. Yeah, that's another big part of it is, and this could take a long time, you know, it could take a while to figure this out in some instances, but that's, you know, depending on how big or small the emotion is and the urge or the urgency of it is, you know, once you figure out what the emotion is and why you're having it, which is hard to do sometimes, then okay, what's the emotion trying to get me to do? What's it trying to say to me? What's it giving me the urge to do? Then you actually make a plan to actually follow the directive of your emotion and address the situation. If it's a boss telling me I have to come in on Saturday and I feel angry and the feeling is anger, and the anger is telling me that I deserve more free time or more pay or something along those lines. Okay, well, what's the plan? Well, maybe the plan is, well, you know, I can't really push back on Saturday because, you know, I don't want to get fired. But what I could do is start paying a lot more attention to my free time in general, and maybe having a conversation with my boss later about expectations and my own work-life balance, or, you know, there's a lot of different plans other than just punching him in the face or saying, I'm not going to do it, right? And then you implement that plan, and then going on here, any emotion after you've done this is extra and can be accepted, but you don't need to feel obligated to address it. Just chiming in. Yeah, that's the perfect, concise way of describing the way I was talking about that. And so I'll just let it stand on its own. Any emotion after you've done this is extra and can be accepted, but you don't need to feel obligated to address it. That's a pretty good way of putting it. Then the last sentence here is, this model is really useful for me as it doesn't label emotions as something to get rid of, but rather our body's natural alert system. End of comment on Reddit. And yeah, just, you know, it's really gratifying when, you know, I'm trying to help and people consider it helpful, and then it just becomes a part of their brain. I'm in their mind. All right, let's take another break. All right, we're back from the break. This next email is from anonymous middle-tier patron. She says, I am only in my second semester of graduate school, and I already feel exhausted from the workload. Second semester grad school, already feel exhausted. My vacations from my job and the breaks between school terms don't match up, so I have not been able to take a single day off in months. Yeah, that's rough. I'm in a doctorate of social work program, so I work on holidays and weekends, sometimes for 12-hour shifts. Wow, that's a lot. But that's being in doctorate school and also working full-time. The last thing I feel like doing on one of those days is cracking open a textbook. Holidays, weekends. So it sounds like the last thing that she wants to do on a day when she could do something else is crack open a textbook. But I don't really have any choice because I don't want to fall behind in school. I really love my program and I don't want to leave it, but I know if I keep going down this path, my work and mental health are going to suffer. Any advice? End of email. Yeah, well, so here are some options. One, you can ask your supervisor. This would be the number one thing I could say. If you listen to one thing, and maybe you've already done this, but if you haven't, or maybe you have, but you haven't really emphasized how bad it is, go to your advisor. That's what they're paid to do. It's one of the things I actually tell my students is that you don't be afraid to ask me questions or to even demand that I help you. I literally get paid by your tuition. You know, when you walk into a massage therapist's office and you give them, I don't know why I'm using that example. When you walk into a McDonald's and you pay for a Big Mac and you never see the Big Mac and you're still hungry, you don't go like, well, I don't want to bother them. No, you stand up and you go, where's my fucking Big Mac? Well, when you're in graduate school, and you are lost or confused or you have questions or you need help, demand it. You've paid for it already. It's not extra. It's not like you're making someone do something that is out of, it's not like you're grabbing some bus driver off the street and saying, where's my Big Mac? You know, you feel entitled when you pay for a Big Mac because you know that you paid for your Big Mac, and the cashier and everyone that works behind the counter is getting paid by the fact that you just forked over that money. Well, the same goes for professors and your advisor. But I almost always found that students were really shy about asking me questions, and they would always say, oh, I'm sorry for bothering you. And I would always say, you're not one, even if you are bothering me, that's my fault. Cause I literally get paid. I pay my mortgage from your tuition. Part of your tuition goes towards my mortgage. So if I'm bothered, then I'm an asshole. So so go to your advisor and who knows if there's any options. Maybe there's an option to slow down with a lighter load. Most schools, you have to take the courses that they give you. You don't have a choice to go slower, but some programs allow you to take a break here and there, or go at a half-time pace kind of a thing, or maybe even just take a year off. Sometimes with the cohort system, if you take any time, you basically have to just take a whole year off and start with the next cohort at the beginning of the year. And that's another option if that feels like something you want to do. The other number two thing I'll say is to just put your nose down and graduate and get by, and don't necessarily worry about absorbing everything. Plenty of time after graduation is there for you to learn more. You know that I say that 99% of what I know about psychology and psychotherapy, I learned outside of graduate school, maybe more. So, and to be a competent clinician, you really do have to use graduate school as just a stepping stone to your eventual pursuit of knowledge throughout your career. Graduate school is not enough knowledge to practice confidently and competently in most situations with most clients moving forward. It'll give you the baseline to learn, but it's not enough. And for clinicians to just go to graduate school and even if they go to continuing ed, they're required, you know, to take continuing ed courses. That is not enough. It's a lot, but it's not enough. So you could say to yourself, well, you know, this isn't really the end-all be-all of my education overall anyway, and so I'm just going to get by. When I was in my second bout of graduate school, I was in a similar situation as you in that I was working full-time as a professor at a part-time practice. I was in a band. I was producing the podcast. I was socializing, barely. And it was hard to also be going to full-time doctoral school. And actually, I was kind of going like more than full-time. And there's typical doctorate psychology program, you might have three or four internships with one really main internship. So, you know, it's a lot of work. And between you and me, there were some classes in which I skimmed the reading material. I did not read it thoroughly. There were some classes where I did, but many of the classes I didn't, because it just wasn't physically possible for me to do so. And, you know, I got by. I passed the classes. I did fine. I did enough. And other classes I would put in more work than was necessary. You know, I always did the work. I wrote the papers and I participated in class, but when it came to and plus I read really slow, so you know, sometimes I would skim. The third thing I'll say as a suggestion, if those two aren't going to work, is to maybe switch to a master's program, or maybe even ask about a terminal master's in your current doctoral program. I don't know what you want to do with your career while you're getting your doctorate, but it's possible that given your career goals, you might actually be able to change your current degree from a doctorate degree into a terminal master's that will terminate a third of the way through a doctorate program, and you get your master's, and then you can get licensed and practice, and then maybe later you go back to get your doctorate, that sort of thing. Or just transfer to a different program or a different school altogether and just take a master's. Master's programs are typically, there's a lot less reading in my anecdotal experience. Not that master's programs don't have reading, but it's much more practical. You know, doctoral programs, there's a pretty high expectation of, well, I don't know, not all doctorate programs, but certainly my doctorate, my psychology doctorate, there was a lot more reading than what I would assign for my students in my master's program. Anyway, so that's another option. The fourth thing I'll say is to consider returning to grad school when your life has more free time. I know some students who have done this. There's no shame in it. It's not a failure. Certainly a lot of people will consider it to be that way, you know, but most people from the outside won't see it that way. It's usually just the student themselves are like, well, I've just totally failed. I've failed. And it's like, you know, in the grand scheme of your life, by the time you die, is, you know, taking a year or two to figure out your situation so that you can return to school at a different time. It doesn't really matter. But, you know, I find that students, they take everything so seriously. You know, a student will fail a course, for example, and they're just like, well, that's it. I'm a terrible therapist and I should just sort of pack it in. And from my vantage point, it has no bearing on your career. I mean, it sets you back by one course. You have to take the course over again. You there's a little bit of humiliation there, but nothing tangible. And it's not like your clients are going to ask you for your transcripts and see that you failed a class and say, you're a terrible therapist, I don't want to work with you. Employers don't ask about it. They barely ask about your grades because, you know, when you're a therapist and you have your associate license or your full license, that's all that pretty much matters. Doesn't matter what school you went to typically. Certainly your grades don't matter. So in my experience, I mean, there are jobs where it does matter, of course, sort of like your elite, sort of uppity kinds of jobs that are government funded or something, or if you're trying to get into a prestigious university to teach or to do, tier one research, that kind of thing. Yeah, sure. But, you know, if you're becoming a clinician, it doesn't matter. So that's another thing. Like, for example, me, when I got my master's, I was fired from my first internship. I mean, that's worse than failing a course. And in the long scheme of things, even in the short scheme of things, it had no bearing on my overall career. You know, if anything, I benefited from being fired because I was able to work at a different internship location and have a much better supervisor. So it just doesn't matter. So taking a year or two off also doesn't really matter. You might lose money because you've already paid for courses, but you've only paid for two semesters. And that's, you know, it couldn't be a lot of money, but it's a lot. You know, imagine if you took a couple more years and then you drop out, you know, it's a lot worse. The fifth thing I'll say is find another work situation if possible. I know it's much easier for me to say that than it is for you to do it, but, maybe there's a job. Like when I was getting my master's, for a time I had a job as a security guard, and I just sat around for hours by myself at night, you know, and I would read and do my homework. So maybe there's some kind of job like that for you where you can do your homework on the job, right? Get paid, double dip there. The sixth thing I'll say is get people to help you in your personal life. Maybe there's chores that they can do for you to lighten the load, or childcare or something. And the seventh thing I'll say is, you know, it's kind of a long shot if everything else has been exhausted, is to find meaning and purpose. You know, if you can't get out of it, you know, if it's really impractical for you to change your job or to switch your course load or something, and you're just like, fuck it, I'm just going to put my head down and do this thing. Maybe finding your purpose, finding a mentor that will give you the oomph to get through it all, that can help. You know, when I was getting my doctorate, I did have that sense of this is going to further my career and I want that. And it got me through, a lot of the turmoil and a lot of the burnout. So, you know, maybe that could help. So let me know if anything like that helps or not, and good luck. All right, this next email is from middle tier patron Raymond from the Netherlands. He says, this email is way overdue, but I still want to tell you a few things. First of all, I wanted to let you know I liked your deep dive about the trial of Johnny Depp and Amber Heard very much. It helped me so much to understand myself and how I cope with trauma and really people in general. The other thing, well, just chiming in here, that's nice to hear, Raymond. I'm really glad. You know, that's why I do this thing. I don't do it just to do it. I do it because I'm genuinely trying to help people going on. The other thing that helped me probably even more was your apology deep dive. You helped me to validate myself. It was just amazing. I remember you talking about how a few times as a child, you had been sadistic to your little brother. Just chiming in. Yeah, I don't know. Did I use the word sadism? but you could word it like that. I had another conversation with my brother about it recently, and he just looks at me like he's a lot. Him and I have a lot in common. We're very different people. Because if someone, you know, like if my older brother apologized to me about something like this, I'd be like, oh, Mark, you know, that's really nice, and what are you gonna do? And I love you and everything. But when I do it for my little brother, he just looks at me like, why are you even talking about this? It's fine. I think he's kind of annoyed. And I just say, Kev, you know, I have a couple of these incidents in my mind, and I just think, oh, what was wrong with me? I'm so sorry. And you know, so that kind of thing. But anyway, going on. I was so struck because I recognize. Sorry. I was so struck. Oh, by the way, just a little story about my little brother Kevin and my parents' 60th. When him and his family were coming out to Lake Chelan a little later. Because they had to, him and his wife had to work over the weekend. And so they were coming out, and while they were on the road is when we discovered that one of us was positive for COVID. And so, I called him and I said, you should know because maybe you want to go back home or so, I don't know. And there was a lot of debate for himself, and you know, I was trying to reassure him that he shouldn't feel obligated. He should just do what he needs to do to protect him and his family. And he decided to turn around and go home. So he did that. And then a couple days later, I and other key family members in Chelan were getting optimistic that the rest of us weren't going to get COVID, and that we had it under control. That we had isolated the one or two individuals that had it, and we might be in the clear. We were still taking precautions, you know, social distancing, staying outside, wearing masks, that kind of stuff. But we're like, well, you know, we're not really complete until Kevin gets here. You know, my two other siblings and I were there. And you know, that was one of the really just great things is when you get my parents and you get all four of the kids, you know, me and my siblings, and you get all the grandkids and all their partners. We're a very completist family. We want everyone to be there. We also just miss people, and you know, my brother's kids are really great. And so I started to have this feeling like, well, I know he turned around and went home, but he's still on vacation with his family. Maybe he could actually come out now that things might be looking a lot better. And so me and my family talked about it, like, yeah, let's ask him. So we asked him, we told him the situation, and he immediately was like, I'm coming out. I was thinking the same thing. I'll leave tomorrow. And so we're like, great. And we're like, yay. And it just was this rather temporary, wonderful little moment of maybe we can... Maybe we can have the 60th wedding anniversary celebration that we had envisioned with everyone here. So the next day was when I discovered that I had it, and I immediately called him and said, don't come out. And he's like, well, I'm already on the road. And so I told him that I had it. And he thought about it a long time, and then he decided that he was going to turn around. So both times, Kevin was on the road with his family, packed up, you know, ready to go. The kids are all excited, you know, because they're going to see all the family, the kids like us and grandma, or what we call bachan, jichan, just Japanese words for grandma and grandpa. And they're going to go to water slides, and they're going to go swimming. You know, of course, everyone's excited, and they just had to turn around and go home again. It just sucks. Anyway, so going back to Raymond's email here, I remember you talking about a few times as a child you had been sadistic with your little brother. I was so struck because I recognized this from my own childhood and have never had the courage to talk about it to anyone, though I suppose I would with my current therapist if I thought it was important enough. I think it was so brave of you to be able to open up about this on the podcast. I think I heard some shame in your voice. Anyway, thank you very much. Chiming in here. Yeah, I am ashamed. And I don't know if it's so brave. I guess if there is something brave about it, it's admitting something that I guess I could get canceled for. You know, people do get canceled for revealing things kind of in this vein, you know, like Lena Dunham a while back. I don't know all the details, but she had admitted maybe in her memoir or something that she had, I think, sexually abused her younger sister. I don't know if she used that term, but it was something along those lines. And I don't know if that's what, I don't know if she's canceled or that was a factor in a cancellation, but certainly there seemed to be some pretty, a movement of ill will against her because of that. And maybe it was justified, I don't know. So maybe it's brave to risk that for myself. Of course, it wasn't of a sexual nature with my younger brother, but anyway. So, yeah, I guess it is kind of a leap to say on the internet. I think I have just learned to be okay with being vulnerable, both on the podcast and otherwise, as I get older. Also, I think it's an important aspect of differentiation and maturity and also being right, being a good person. I think an important element to all that is to fully admit your faults and what you've done that was wrong, without people asking you to do it. I think it's very important for all of us to be able to do that confidently and without any ifs, ands, or buts. You know, it's not like I'm saying, "Well, I did that to Kevin, but you know, he did it to me sometimes," or "I did it to Kevin, but you know, my older brother did it to me sometimes." You know, it's just like I did this, full stop, and I'm ashamed. I was insecure. I probably felt powerless, and I wanted power in my life. Actually, it's probably what it was. You know, I was 12, 13, and I was just so desperate to be accepted by my peers. And you know, if I were to say this to any of my classmates back then, they'd be, "So what are you talking about? You know, people liked you. You were popular, and no one bullied you. What are you talking about?" And I'd say, like, "Well, yeah, but I was insecure anyway." And I probably came home and said, "Well, subconsciously, I can have power over someone. I can, another part of the power play with my younger brother was that, I won't go down that road again. Going on with the email. I have a personal trainer who teaches me how to box and deal with my emotions in social situations as an addition to my psychotherapy. Okay. I have a personal trainer who teaches me how to box and deal with my emotions. He is following education to become a psychomotor therapist. I don't know if this exists in the US or what it's called, but I suppose you have an idea. Just chiming in. I don't know. I don't know if we have quote unquote psychomotor therapists in the United States. I could see that going either way. Like, is that an occupational therapist where someone is actually like a personal trainer, but more hands-on and helping people with functioning in life movement-wise? Sometimes when occupational therapists tell me what they do, I get confused. I know I can just Google it right now, but I've known occupational therapists, and when they tell me what they do, I actually do at work, I'm like, huh, okay. But so I don't know if it's that kind of psychomotor therapist or if it's like a dance movement therapist where they're more like me, but they use movement as a way to help people with their emotions and process things and, you know, work on trauma. Anyway, going on. He is originally from Rwanda, and his name is Kirk Ponda. Isn't that amazing? I mean, two people who are so pivotal to my recovery process with an almost identical name. End of email. Yeah, that is hilarious. Kirk Ponda. from Rwanda. Kirk Ponda from Rwanda. There's got to be some kind of limerick in there. If anyone can... actually, you know what? I've been learning that ChatGPT does some really hilarious things. So I'm gonna type it in here. Please, I always try to be polite to ChatGPT. I don't understand. I don't know why, but please be... Oh, no, sorry. Please be polite. I wrote a song called Please Be Polite. Please write a limerick... with the following two phrases, quote, Kirk Honda. Well, that's by Dr. Kirk Honda. Well, yeah, because then maybe it'll include my expertise in the limerick. And let's see. It's a psycho or... Personal trainer Kirk Ponda. Let's see what it says. There once was a doc, Dr. Kirk Honda, whose wisdom was known far and yonder. He diagnosed ills with therapeutic skills like a personal trainer Kirk Ponda. It ends so dumb. Let me say, okay. Please try again. In the world of health, meet Dr. Kirk Honda with expertise that reaches beyond a Fonda. What in the? As a doc, he's renowned. And it's quite renowned, that's the same word, that personal trainer Kirk Ponda is the mantra. Oh, that's just too good. I'm going to compliment ChatGPT. Thank you. That was LOL. Let's see what they say. You're welcome. I'm glad you enjoyed it. yeah. Middle tier patron Raymond, that is truly bizarre. Because Kirk is a rare name. Yeah, Kirk Ponda and Kirk Honda. Yeah, well, maybe one day I'll meet Kirk Ponda from Rwanda, and then we could stand next to each other, Raymond, and you could just be like, "There's Kirk Honda, Dr. Kirk Honda, and Kirk Ponda." Maybe you'll have a cough then, too. All right, let's go into another email. This next email is from middle tier patron Teresa. She says, "Hi, Dr. Kirk. I would love to know your thoughts on how to be a good friend when it comes to empathy. I find that I sometimes feel lonely and inferior in conversations where I share some struggles and the other person doesn't share any struggles about their own life. Is this normal?" Let me look at this again. I feel lonely and inferior in conversations where I share my own struggles, but the other person doesn't share any struggles about their life. Is that normal? Yeah, it's normal to feel like you're putting yourself out on a limb, like you're being vulnerable while the other person is being standoffish, maybe. I mean, it kind of depends. Anyway, so going on here. If a friend shares struggles with me, I always try to empathize by relating to it to my own struggles, even if they happened in the past. Just chiming in. Yeah, so there's a lot of chatter about this very issue on the internet that I see. And sometimes people will say that they hate it when they're sharing a struggle and their friend will share by or will show empathy or the thing that, sorry, COVID brain. On the internet, what I'll hear people talking in real life, people will say, you know, I hate it when I'm talking about a difficult situation I'm going through and the person listening will just talk about a difficult situation that's similar that they've gone through or that they're going through. And they'll say, you know, that's not good listening. That's just narcissistic or self-centered or something. And it really just depends on a number of things. You can absolutely, because this person, Teresa, is saying, that's what I want someone to do. When I share my struggles, I want someone to empathize by talking about their struggles. So what I'll say is that I found this to be true a long time ago, like 20 plus years ago. I started noticing this difference in people because I'm that way. There's a phrase for this, like you empathize through relating or something, but or maybe I had a phrase for this back in the day that COVID has killed now, but I remember noticing that there's kind of two different kinds of people, you know, and there's obviously people in the middle, but often people are at one end of the spectrum on this, where some people, when they listen, they don't insert themselves at all. And they empathize. And you say, wow, you know, that must be hard for you, or tell me more, or how was that for you? So that's on one end of the spectrum. I'll get to the other dimension. Then you have people on the other end of the spectrum who almost always, if not always, empathize through relating, where they'll say, oh my God, the same thing happened to me last year and it was the worst and da, 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 da. Okay, so now there are people who have no empathy or impaired empathy or have trouble with empathy. And that's a different topic. But if we're talking about people with empathy that are feeling your feelings and are having compassion for you, both ends of the spectrum can be true with someone who has compassion and believes they are conveying compassion. So the person on, you know, the one end of the spectrum that doesn't relate, that just focuses on you, they're thinking, okay, I need to be a good friend right now. I'm going to listen well. I'm going to ask questions. I'm going to focus on them. And I'm certainly not going to insert myself because that's narcissistic. On the other end of the spectrum, the people who relate, and this is like me, now, as a therapist, I don't do this. I can do this at times, but as a therapist, I don't do this. But as a friend, I will. And what I'm trying to convey is, oh my God, I get it because I've been through it. And let me describe how shitty it was for me. And so I can prove to you, because it's one thing to just say, oh my God, that sounds difficult. But let me demonstrate to you that I know how that feels because I've been through it, or you know, something akin to that. Now, of course, if someone is talking about how their husband died, and I'm just like, oh my God, I know exactly how you feel. My cat died a few years ago. You know, I wouldn't do that because that I would understand that that doesn't help, and it's not the same, right? It involves similar feelings, but it would be really demeaning. So there are obviously situations where I can't relate because I haven't had anything like that before. And therefore I wouldn't offer up my own story. Right. Also, if I do offer up my own story, I'm gauging the situation and reading the room and, determining at least as best I can in the moment, trying to figure out what is the best response. Anyway, sorry, that sounds a little robotic that I would just try to determine the best response, but you know what I mean? Anyway, So it sounds to me like, Teresa, you are someone that is, that's what you're looking for. But you might be running into people who are at the other end of the spectrum and are, they think that if they relate their own story, it actually is counter to empathy, which isn't necessarily true. So you can certainly ask people, hey, or even just tell people, hey, I'm the sort of person that when I share a story and my struggles, if you want, and you don't have to, but the best way you can convey empathy to me is if you also share your own difficulties, if you want to, or a similar situation that you've been through. I guess I'm just looking for some camaraderie. Like, I want to feel normalized in my own struggles, because it'd be nice to hear if other people struggled in similar ways. You can certainly ask for that. Going on here. Is it a good rule of thumb that friendship involves a balance of vulnerability? What if one friend has more struggles than the other? End of email. Yeah, that those are two different things to talk about briefly here, is a balance in vulnerability. It depends, but what do I say? Every relationship's different. And I'm sort of walking through my relationships in my life, and I think it's absolutely valid if you feel like someone isn't opening up to say, "Hey, I'd really love it if you opened up more." There's a lot of things that happen when two people open up. One is which is you both give the opportunity to give support. Often we think about being vulnerable as a one-directional kind of thing. Like, okay, I'm being vulnerable and you're taking care of me, right? But it's really two-directional in a variety of ways. One of the variety of ways is that, so if I'm being vulnerable, I'm giving you myself. So this is not only are you giving to me because you're supporting me, but I'm giving you my trust. And you now know that I trust you, which is making you feel better. You know what I mean? Or if I flipped it and someone's being vulnerable to me, I'm recognizing, when I care to recognize it, meaning when I care to be conscious of it, that, this person is confiding in me and being really nice to me by opening up to me. It's quite an honor. The other thing is I feel a lot of gratification when I can help someone. And so I get a boost when I'm taking care of someone who's vulnerable. I feel better about myself. I feel like I did a good deed, and that's a gift as well, right? So, there's a lot of things that are, that the person who is giving to the vulnerable person, there's a lot of things that they're getting as well. Okay. There's that. The other thing is that when we feel needed by the other person, it makes us feel more secure. Now there's a downside to that of being in control or being codependent or something. I need you to need me. But, for example, me and my wife, there's mutual neediness. Right now, she's sick and sicker than she was earlier, and I'm getting better. And so I feel like she kind of needs me, and I'm helping her. I'm tending to her. I got her an ice pack for her head, and I ordered food for her a little bit ago, and I'm, paying attention to her and being nice and kissing her and hugging her and, just that, right? So when, now she could say, "I don't need anything. Oh, I'm fine." Or I could go to her and say, "Hey, would you like an ice pack or something?" She'd be like, "No, I'll get it." And then I'll be like, no, I'll get it." And she's like, "No, I insist." And she goes to the thing and she gets an ice pack. That sucks because, one, why would she do that to herself without allowing me to help her? But two, you know, I want to feel like she depends on me because I certainly depend on her. You know, when there's only one direction of dependence and neediness, it makes the person who is not needed feel like they might be thrown away. Plus, you know, there's also just this this preference thing, right? Like, everyone needs things from other people. And if you don't turn to, you know, like if Stacy, when she's sick right now, if she just always called one of her friends or her mom and didn't ask me, then one, it would feel insulting. Like, wait, do you feel like I can't help you? Or it would also feel like, why don't you want to depend on me? You know, I thought we were a team together, you know? So it's another thing that you can think about and ask from people around you if you feel like they're not reciprocating in that way. The other thing that you say here is, you know, what if one friend has more struggles than the other? You know, that's another good thing that you're thinking about, because, you know, I can think about friendships that I've been in where that has been the case, where they definitely are going through a lot more struggles than I am. And so, and I might be one of their only friends. And so when they come to me and they're talking about all the struggles, and I don't really bring up much in my life around that, those lines about struggles and stuff, because I don't really have those kind of struggles, you know, then in those relationships, it can feel and be a little one-sided, a little one-directional. And I'm, you know, maybe I'll chime in every now and then with a little bit of my own life or something. But I guess now that I think about it, I do try to balance the scales a little bit, not only just because I have my own needs that I want that friend to maybe meet, but also I want to normalize it and just, because I probably do intuit that if, you know, like, let's say a friend of mine is talking about how horrible their marriage is going, and it's been chronic and been going on for a couple years, and I've been there off and on through those 2 years, and over time I start realizing, like, you know, I don't think I've ever complained about my wife to this friend. It might seem like our relationship is perfect or something. Well, I might, and I do have this intuition at times where I'll just be like, when I can legitimately relate, I'll be like, oh yeah, I can relate to that one. I've run into that before. And if I were to fully describe it, I might say like, but you know, it's not a big deal and we always work it out. I might not emphasize that in the moment because I want them to feel like they're not alone, that they are having those kinds of struggles. It's like, yeah, you know, I've been there too, and our relationship suffers in a similar way. I'm, you know, it might be clear that it might not be as bad, but I might offer that up. But, you know, some people might feel, might not have that intuition, or might not even be able to relate. And if you're having a lot of struggles and, you know, you have a friend who is, you know, not struggling so much, and but they want to be there for you, then it can be a little one-sided, which isn't a bad thing. And there's not really a solution to that, you know. But it kind of sounds to me overall, Teresa, that you might be feeling like, do these people really care? That's one question that I'm guessing you're asking. And is there something wrong with me that I have so many struggles? Because if you don't, you know, if it's like, Teresa, you're talking to your friend, you're just like, how come they don't have any struggles? How come I have all these struggles? Is there something wrong with me? Am I going to push these people away? Yeah, it's just another thing to think about. There could be some work there for you to work on, which is to either deepen your relate. Because, you know, I can have a friend that can be struggling. Let's say, you know, this fictional friend, 2 years of a marriage struggling, and they are very frequently in a very bad place and personally and with their marriage, and I almost never bring up anything that I'm struggling with. And then at some point he says to me, you know, I feel like I'm always being vulnerable and struggling, and you're not so much, and it kind of bothers me. You know, let's say through our conversation, I'm just like, well, I want you to know that I care and love you. And yeah, I could certainly share about my own life, but I don't know, like, I'm not really struggling in that way right now. I have in the past, but I'm not right now. And that doesn't mean that I look down on you or I think that you're annoying or something. I'm absolutely here for you. And when the tables are turned, then, you know, I would hope that you would be there for me at that moment. But right now, I'm doing okay, I guess. I don't think it has to be balanced, I guess is what I'm saying, in order for the relationship to be legit. I'm guessing that for you, Teresa, there's other insecurities at play or distance issues between you and your friend that are real. You know, it's not an insecurity of yours. It's a real thing. Some sort of distance that's happening that maybe you could address. Because I would worry, Teresa, that you'd go to your friend and be like, "I need you to be vulnerable. You know, I need you to have struggles." And I said earlier, you could certainly say that and suggest that, and that might be a solution. But it's another possibility that if you felt more overtly, you know, secure in the relationship, that the imbalance in the struggle talk wouldn't concern you as much. Okay, I can tell that my brain is not working correctly, and the food is here. So I'm going to now eat. The other thing is, I haven't eaten all day. It's like 7:30, and I haven't eaten all day. I've had just like zero appetite. I take that back. I have some appetite, but not as much as I usually do. So I think another factor in my brain not working is I haven't eaten, which isn't good. I don't recommend that. Don't follow me in that thing, that behavior. Okay. All right. Signing off from COVID land, and everyone please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, really, really do.